Welcome to the Be Curious podcast, the podcast that champions solutions to some of the world's biggest problems. I'm your host, Louise Houghton, and in each episode, we get curious about a different subject, from the food that we eat, to the clothes that we wear, to ocean plastic and overflowing landfills. All of our guests have brilliant minds and innovative ideas that allow us to live a more sustainable, conscious, and pollutant-free life. And the best part is, this podcast is not just about listening. It's about building a community and connecting like-minded individuals who are curious about alternative ways to enhance their lives and the longevity of the planet. And if you're curious already and want to win some sustainable products or services gifted to us from our many guests, then just head over to our Instagram for more information. You can find out how to enter at becurious_. I am so excited to be bringing the stories in this podcast to you all. It is such a pleasure to share what companies and organizations are doing for future generations. Everyone featured works in a sustainable way, and I love how much people are on the same page, wanting to create and innovate in order to make change. If you feel the same, then why not follow in my footsteps and sign the Science Declaration? This declaration is a call to all nations, societies, and organizations to devote more resources to the advancements of science and technology. They're encouraging people internationally to join forces in battling debilitating diseases, ensuring sufficient food for a growing world population, stopping the destruction of our environment, and engaging in joint endeavors to elucidate the secrets this fascinating universe holds. To add your name, go to make-science-not-war.org and take an active stand to demand more money is put into improving rather than destroying our world. You can also hear more about this declaration at the Future Insight Conference that's being held in Mainz, Germany on the 10th and 11th of July. Over the 2 days, academic and industry leaders will come together to share their knowledge and latest innovations. The conference focuses on interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary conversations and will cover topics of science, technology, and everything else making huge steps forward in their prospective industries. You're also welcome to enter competitions and contribute to their dream board, a place that allows you to dream big and share your visions for the future, what you want to see invented, and why. It's really your chance to get involved and take an active role in leaving the planet in a better place than when you were born onto it. That's how I see it anyway, and I hope you share the same view. To check out the competitions, get tickets, or write out your dreams, head to curiousfutureinsight.org for more information. In this episode, we're getting curious about our food and what we actually are putting into our bodies. Because if the saying you are what you eat is actually one that lives true, then we are a combination of microplastics and too many toxins to even actually think about. Here to shed some light on that is chef, filmmaker and co-founder of Comma Table Creative, Oliver English. Thank you so much for joining us today, Oliver.
Great to be here.
Now, this subject is one of the most pressing ones in my mind that I hear about here in the US especially, because if we're not actually putting nutrient-dense food into our bodies, then how are we actually able to function to our optimum? Where did this idea, you know, for all of the things that you're doing actually come from? Where did you first see it be a problem?
7+ years ago, I was opening a restaurant in the Bahamas, and I went into the walk-in refrigerator, and I started looking at all the produce, and it looked, you know, sad and depleted. And I was like, chef, we have a 270-seat restaurant here. This produce is not going to work. We've got to figure something out. And he said, everything that's coming into the restaurant is being held up in the ports because it's being coming in from other countries. And by the time it gets here, it's been 3, 4, 5 days and it looks really sad. So I said, hey, can you guys help me find a local farm to get some local produce for the restaurant? And the first place they send me is this indoor hydroponic cucumber farm. And I walk in and very impressive floor to ceiling cucumbers, like a lot of vibrancy looking around. But I started walking around this facility and realized that all of these cucumbers are being grown with this in these artificial growth mediums. And then you look at the chemical room and it's this, all of these guys in hazmat suits pumping chemicals through the system. Something didn't quite feel right to me. So I ended up going outside, going for a walk and meeting this amazing farmer named Sakane. And Sakane, by contrast to this sort of indoor hydroponic situation, greets me with a big smile, big farmer hat, and welcomes me to come check out the farm that he's working on with his family. They're working on this incredible little organic farm to create healthy food for the environment in the Bahamas. He shared with me that the weather patterns that he grew up with are so different from the ones today that he doesn't know what to plant. We looked into the distance and we said, and I said, Sakane, what's that? He said, there used to be 10,000 farms, 12,000 farms in the Bahamas. Now there are 1,200. Everything has been industrialized in the U.S., wrapped in styrofoam and plastic, sent in. And there's so much waste that they send it to the landfill and they burn it. And he also said that he was one of the first people in his family to go plant-based and one of the only ones to not develop a chronic disease.
And so this is the first time that you realize that this food industry is, you know, in a catastrophic state.
Yes, it was the first time. Here I am on the farm with this farmer, and it's the first time that someone is explaining to me in real time how deeply interconnected our food system is with every aspect of our lives, from our environment to human health to our society. And I said, Sakane, how do we get people to change? And he said, and I'll never forget this, if I can feed people good quality food, I can change the way they look at food and in turn change the way they look at life. And after that moment, I was like, more people need to meet farmers. Where is that disconnect? And my little brother is actually a filmmaker at the New York Film Academy. I called him, told him about this amazing experience, and he said, let's tell him we're going to come film an interview with him about the future of food. I told Sakane, we're going to come film an interview with you in a couple months. He's like, what do you mean? And I was like, I don't really know. We're going to figure it out. No idea what we were doing. But we came back 3 months later and filmed our first interview with Sakane and the team he was working with about the future of food. And by then we were looking at climate change, population growth, health epidemics. We realized all of these big macro challenges we were facing and asked ourselves, what role does our food system play in contributing to these issues? And more importantly, what role can our food system play in contributing to the solutions to these issues from an environmental health and a societal perspective?
Well, this is great, interesting work. And so you went back about 7 years ago to do that first interview, did you?
Yeah, so that was the beginning. And from there, we were so inspired by that interview that we were like, what other innovators are out there creating positive change in the food system? We know all the doom and gloom. We know all the negative headlines. But who are the people who are creating real tangible examples, real tangible solutions in the fields that are connected to our food system? So in agriculture, in healthcare, in education, what does the future of health and sustainability look like? And who's out there right now today creating and exhibiting working models that we can then emulate and scale?
And like with all documentaries, really, yours started out as something maybe a little bit smaller and then grew into something so much bigger than I think you ever imagined. Tell me a bit more about that process.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a dream that we had, you know, back in the day. We rolled out some butcher block paper on our mom's counter, and we kind of created this like vision for what the film could be. And I think I knew what I wanted it to be, but the gap between what I wanted it to be and what we were capable of doing or knew how to do or understood what to do was so wide that we had to keep chipping away at it for 7 years. And it was those first couple meetings. And then those meetings led us to meeting other people that led us to meeting other people in the industry. And we started to meet all of these incredible innovators over the years who together would create this tapestry of what the future of food could look like. We wanted to tell stories of hope and inspiration and positivity, and we wanted to tell an interconnected story. By doing so, showing solutions from all these different areas in the world of healthcare, environmental issues, and societal, where does food intersect with all of those, and how can food be a powerful vehicle for change? And if we start to ask questions about where our food comes from, can we get people to start asking questions about where the clothes come from, where the shampoo comes from, how the car is being powered, etc.?
Start getting curious, which is what we're doing on this podcast.
Start getting curious. So we know from regenerative agriculture, which we talk about in the film, and regenerative systems, that our consumption through our food choices can have a net positive impact on the environment and on the world around us, which is where we need to move as a society.
And we haven't actually mentioned the name of the film. It's called Feeding Tomorrow.
Yes.
It's out on Apple and also on Amazon Prime.
Yes, Apple TV, Amazon Prime, Google Play. And we launched on a couple international airlines, if I may, the past couple of weeks. So we are on Emirates, New Zealand, Virgin, and we'll be launching on Korean Tap and a couple others in the coming months. So very exciting, but you can find us all around. We're also in a couple school systems as well, but we're very happy that the film is out there in the world and people can see it and hopefully be inspired by it.
Well, congratulations. It's a fantastic film and it's got so many amazing stories and messages within it. So definitely one to watch. And you talk a lot in it, as you just mentioned, about regenerative agriculture. Now, for somebody listening who doesn't know what that is, can you explain it a little bit more?
Sure. It's actually kind of a more old school way, of growing food. The way that we have been growing food conventionally for the past seven decades has been a system where we incentivize the farmers to tear down all the trees, get rid of the animals, get rid of all the plants that were there, grow one type of crop, usually corn, soy, or wheat. We pump it full of chemicals. We call that progress, and that is all we do. And that's why if you drive anywhere through the Midwest, where I know you just were, there's fields and fields of corn that just seemingly go forever.
And the seeds as well.
They're all Terminator seeds. So those are the majority of those are GMO seeds that are genetically bred to withstand a lot of chemicals, largely glyphosate, and also not reproduce, so that farmers are forced, not even incentivized, forced to buy the seed year after year, which is just horrible practice. But anyways, the industrialized system, all those practices taken together are really bad for soil health. They destroy the life of the soil by tilling it up. It makes it very vulnerable to wind and rain. It also destroys biodiversity and habitat for species. That system over the long term destroys and denigrates our long-term ability to be here on this planet. That system is so destructive that in 2015, the United Nations said that we have 60 years of harvest left based on the rate at which we are degrading topsoil around the world. So today, in 2024, we have 51 years of harvest left. Let's drink that in for a minute. 51 years. If we were to continue the rate at which we are degrading our topsoil around the world, we will be able to produce food for 51 more years. In the current trajectory. That is within our lifetimes. That is definitely within our children's lifetimes. That is monumentally disruptive and has huge implications for humanity. And so by contrast, to actually answer your question, the regenerative paradigm is creating and supporting farming systems that together through the way that they are farmed, enhance the overall quality and health of the system through time. So by planting trees and integrating animals and really focusing on the health of the soil through covering the crops and not using chemicals, all of these systems taken together create an environment where the health of the system grows through time, and you can actually sequester carbon and build resilience to climate change. So this type of system, which is organic plus, so it's regenerative, is healing the planet through time, through the processes that are in place.
With regenerative farming, as I understand it too, when you're talking about the health of the soil, that healthy soil is soil that is like rich, dark color, you know, that it's got worms and other different types of insects living in it. And the microbiome in the soil is what's really strong and rich. That will just sort of biodegrade anything really quickly. And so it's those nutrients, as I understand it, that will then go into the food that we're eating, or that will then go into our bodies and improve our own gut microbiome. When you listen to that kind of evidence there on regenerative farming, and then you hear about the industrial that you just talked about and all the pesticides, insecticides, you kind of start to wonder what those things are doing to our body, if it's not like the healthy benefits that we just talked about. So what can you share about all of those insecticides and pesticides and the impact that they have on our bodies?
You touched on something very important there, and that is the deep, undeniable interconnection between the healthiest farms and the healthiest food, and by contrast, the unhealthiest farms and the unhealthiest food. And what you were just saying is absolutely fundamentally correct, and that is the foundation of health, of any healthy food, and then any plants that we eat, any animals that we eat, any animals that eat the plants that we eat, all of that comes from soil, ultimately. So the health and the nutrient density and the quality of the soil is the foundation for that, the plant's health. So going back to this example we were just talking about, the soil that is being grown and utilized in regenerative systems, because of all of the different elements that are put into place, is the healthiest soil. So the food that comes from these farms is going to be the most nutrient dense. It is going to have, and therefore it's also going to have the highest flavor because it's going to have the most nutrient density, and it's going to be the most healing for us and restorative for our guts as well. By contrast, the food that is coming from farms that are not focused on soil health, that are using tremendous amounts of agrochemicals, petrochemicals that come from really, really far away, those systems are artificially designed because of the GMO seeds to withstand huge amounts of glyphosate, which has been known and documented to give us cancer all over the country. In summary, one system is contributing to the destruction and disease of our environment and destroying our human health. One system is restoring, regenerating, and replenishing our environment and also doing that to our own health. How we treat the soil and how we treat the environment is how we treat our own bodies. And there is a reason that we have so much cancer and sickness and chronic disease in this country. And it is because we have broken and destroyed our food system.
Tell me a bit more about your journey as food being medicine, because I know that that was also something that kind of got you into this movement.
For sure. Struggled with acne my whole life. When I was younger, they gave me every doxycycline, minocycline, penicillin, all of these antibiotics. So many. Topical, oral, everything. And
which probably did nothing for your gut health.
Precisely. It destroyed my gut health. I ended up taking Accutane, which, for those of you who don't know, is the most intense form of antibiotic. Who knows what's in there? It's so bad that they tell women they can't take it because it'll give their babies birth defects. Like, it is not good.
Oh, wow.
My mom was so adamantly against this. She's like more of an organic hippie mom. She was right. So adamantly against this, but I did it and it helped for a little period of time. But it is so toxic that I had to get blood tests every month to make sure I wasn't drinking. Again, women can't take it. It's a horrible impact. It worked for a little bit, then I started breaking out again. I go back into this dermatologist and I said, "Hi, ma'am." I explained my whole history and I said, "Look, I'm 27 years old. I still have acne. I've done all of this stuff for like years." And she said, "The only thing that you can do is do Accutane again." And I was like, "Ma'am, I'm not doing that again.
There's got to be another way."
And I started working on the film. And I said, "I've been working on this documentary. All of these experts have said to us, food impacts your health, like, obviously." And she goes, quote, I'll never forget this. She goes, "There's not enough conclusive evidence to determine that food impacts acne." And in my head, I'm thinking, that's bullshit. I'm like, absolutely not. And she goes, "You have to do Accutane." And I was like, at this point also, I'm like so embarrassed for my acne. I'm like, whatever, fine, I'll do it. Again, my mom was not about it. I did it for 3 weeks. It made me so angry, like in the middle of the day, after 3 weeks, that I stopped doing it. I came out to California and I ended up taking some blood tests. And they told me that I had a horrible leaky gut because all of these antibiotics that I was taking to heal my acne were destroying my gut.
Heal in inverted commas.
And then I was becoming more susceptible to gluten and to alcohol or whatever I was eating or whatever it was that was, you know, inflammatory. So I had this very, I think, common experience in America where you have an ailment, you have an issue, whether it's your skin or it's your body, whatever, and they tell you, take this pill, don't change anything you're doing, take this pill and it'll solve it. And it's not you, it's not your behavior, it's not what you're putting in your body, it's not. Just take this pill and you're fine. Just, you can keep doing what you're doing.
When you say it now, it just sounds so ludicrous.
It's insane. and so that was my version of realizing. And then I started to eat more foods that were healing my gut. I sort of really started to eliminate the things that were causing me inflammation. And I still struggle with acne, but it's less bad than it was for a lot of my life. And I still think I'm struggling with a little bit of a leaky gut from all those years of all those antibiotics. So that was a really long way of me saying it took me a long time to realize how powerfully healing food can be. And at the same time to question, you know, just taking a pill and making it better when you don't have to address any of the issues that caused it, when you really do. And
again, like, I wonder what difference it would have been if you have an apple that's just made on, you know, a regular industrial farm to an apple that's made from regenerative farm with all of these extra nutrients and things that are in it that are going to be more beneficial for your body and your gut and therefore your skin.
100%. And when we make decisions, when we buy food that's local, we buy food that's regenerative, when we buy food that's in season, whether it's at the grocery store or we're going to restaurants that support these ideas, we are having a dual, deep, interconnected impact on our own health and on the environment. So when we support the healthiest, most nutrient-dense foods, we are also supporting environmental and planetary health. And there's a beautiful realization and connection there. And because the quality of the health of the soils determine the quality of the health of our bodies and the long-term health and success of the planet.
Again, you are what you eat.
Amen.
If you're like me, then you're curious about the future and what that will look like for our children and our children's children. A great place to feed my curiosity is at the Curious Future Insight Conference that happens every other year. I've already got my tickets to head to Mainz, Germany on the 10th and 11th of July for this year's edition. Over the 2 days, academic and industry leaders will come together to share their knowledge and their latest innovations. They will talk about the problems we're encountering on a global scale. But this is not a conference that focuses on everything going wrong. Quite the opposite. The Future Insight Conference is a really positive and uplifting place to be because the speakers have been working for years on solutions. From major players like Merck to startups only a few months old, the lineup of keynotes and panels really show the seniority in each industry. And the best part is that everyone is talking about what they're doing to make a difference in the world. This year, among many others, they have the CEO of BioNTech, Ugur Sahin, the founder of Boston Dynamics, Mark Rybert, and also the Nobel Prize winner and professor, Stephen Chu. It's a place where you can connect with like-minded individuals in academia and industry, take part in workshops like the Microplastics Hackathon, and you may even be interested in entering yourself or your company into one of the many competitions they have running annually. They have the Nature Spinoff Prize, Science and Shorts Prize, and the Future Insight Prize is the creme de la creme, awarding €500,000 as a helpful research grant. If you want to find out more about the event and grab your tickets, head over to curiousfutureinsight.org to find out more information. I'll also put a link to the page in the show notes. And if you do come and you see me there, please don't be shy and say hi. It would be such a pleasure to connect with you all.
So if we're realizing the error of our ways, then how do we go about changing them back to that old school method that you talked about?
We already have the solutions. We already know the most sustainable ways to grow food. We already know what regenerative agriculture looks like. The truth is that the many indigenous communities and communities of color all over the world, and people in general, have been using these regenerative practices forever, which are basically lots of different types of plants and animals and trees, all integrated into a system that are healthy, and they enhance the system through time. They're not using chemicals that come from far away. The cattle and the goats and the sheep are pooping and peeing and fertilizing the fields, and they are working in harmony with nature. We lost sight of that deep connection to nature. So the solution is honoring and respecting a more old school traditional way of farming in harmony with nature, where we are not separate from and here to dominate with our agrochemicals and our petrochemicals. We are here to work in harmony with nature. And in this transition, we need a significant increase in the amount of farms that are farming in this way. And to do that, we need both consumer awareness to support the transition, and we also need policy change to really speed up the transition and do it in an equitable way.
I know you're also working with the American Farmland Trust. So what are they doing to help farmers switch to a more regenerative agriculture?
Absolutely. So AFT, who I love, is an incredible organization. They've been working with farmers on both sides of the aisle for almost 50 years. And they have three sort of key things that they do. One is making sure that farmland in the United States remains as farmland. There's a lot of acres a day are being lost to development. Second thing is making sure that young farmers are able to transition into the spot that old farmers are aging out of. 40% of farmers in the U.S. are going to be aging out in the next couple of years, which presents a huge opportunity and brings me to the next point. And to answer your question, they help farmers transition to sustainable practices. They help give with grants, and they also help them with the technical assistance to do that. And I think the main thing they do is they help create this sort of community support network group of other farmers, older, younger, who are working in your geographic area, who are further ahead in the transition, who can help you with that transition. And the really big opportunity here too is that because so many are aging out, that presents a huge opportunity to bring in the next generation of farmers. And the young farmers, as we know through AFT, are significantly more likely to want to grow in this regenerative way. Yeah. So we are at a moment in time that is a fundamentally incredible opportunity if we can transition 40 to 50% of the farming workforce in the next decade.
But how long does it take to actually change a farm from an industrial to a regenerative farm? Because if you're saying that all that soil is dead, totally, it must take a while to bring it back to life.
It does. But they say the best time to plant a tree was 40 years ago, and the second best time is today or yesterday. Point being, like, let's get to work. Sure, it is going to take some time. But the main farm in our film, which you saw, the main farmer, Mark Shepherd, who's this amazing agroforestry permaculture guy, you know, really real food warrior. He took 110 acres of conventional corn and soy land in the Midwest and transitioned it into one of North America's most advanced permaculture sites. It took him 20 to 25 years. And that is the long horizon we're talking about here. But we need to start thinking in terms of seven generations. We need to start applying the lens that many Native people in this country used for a long time. We've got to eliminate the 1 to 3 year time horizon that is so much the foundation of everything that we do in business and life. And right now we're caught up in this 1, 2, 3 year profit model. We need to be thinking about seven generations. And so as we think about this transition, yes, it's not going to happen in 1, 2, or 3 years, but we need to start now because
the farmers actually make more money too, right?
Yes.
You know, it might take them a little while to get there, but then they don't have to pay for the pesticides, the insecticides.
And so we need to help. We, the policymakers in the country, we, the taxpayers, and we, the consumers, need to work together to help this large-scale transition in farming in the next decade. It could be the most important thing that we do within the broader context of the environmental movement, of course.
So let's talk a bit more about that then and how regenerative farming is actually helping the climate crisis that we're under right now.
The regenerative idea is incredibly important for the future of the environmental movement. In agriculture, what we see is the industrial system releases carbon into the air, contributes to climate change. Regenerative agriculture has the capacity to sequester tremendous amounts of carbon. So through the farming that we do, we can actually draw down significant amounts of carbon in the air, store it in the soils. And so the food system becomes an active carbon sink and soils become an active carbon sink. In addition, the regenerative systems are the most resilient to climate change. We have interviewed farmers all over the world. Again, 60 farms all over the world. Every single one of them has said to us, in different languages, different backgrounds, different parts of the world, climate change is not a faraway thing on some chart and some deck. They are dealing with extreme weather, droughts, floods, heat waves like they have never seen, like they did not grow up with right now today.
The changes, it's one extreme to the other,
and
isn't
it? Huge. It used to be predictable, like what Sakani told me. Now I've seen that, heard that from farmers all over the world. But now it's 4 months of drought. And then when it rains for 10 days straight, and they just can't handle it. And so we need to be thinking about what can we do today. But we need to be thinking about, again, that seven generations thinking is these systems are also the most resilient to droughts, floods, heat waves, extreme weather, all of these things that we see in this country and around the world.
They withstand
every day. These systems are fundamental to withstanding it and being a partner in combating, but also withstanding.
Now, I see you at farmers markets all the time as well, Oliver. I think it's actually the first place that we ever actually met. And so it's not just about regenerative farming. It's about local farming for you. Why is that so important?
For me, local is very important for a couple of reasons. First of all, it has it's the lowest possible environmental impact.
Because it doesn't have to travel.
So much of the food that we eat now, we're so used to having everything in the grocery store all year round, which is just not physically practical in the long term and not really realistic.
So you eat more seasonally as well.
Exactly. So eating in season means that you're really respecting what the earth can provide and what your region can provide in that particular time of year.
And would you say what your body needs then at that particular time
of
year
too? I would say, because also back to this whole gut health thing is what we've learned from all these nutritionists is variety and variety in color and variety. If you're just eating broccoli every single day, that's good. But it's really about getting the variety of color and the diversity of nutrients, micronutrient, macronutrients come from different colors. Each different part color of the rainbow has different micro and macronutrients. They say eat the rainbow. That is very true. And they have different compounds and elements that are all beneficial to health. And so just having one, you're neglecting the other ones. Also, local is really important because as soon as you harvest a plant, it starts to die. As soon as you cut it from its life source, from the soil, it starts to die. So some fruits and vegetables within 48 hours can lose up to a third or more or a half of their nutritional value.
Within 48 hours?
Potentially some of them, yes. If they're not stored correctly, et cetera. So there's a huge range for different fruits and vegetables, how they're stored, et cetera.
Right, because some are even picked when they're not ripe.
Some are picked too soon. That's also why. But in general, you want to eat as close to the source as you can. You're going to have the most nutrient dense possible, which is why it's also great to, in your own front yard, grow some herbs or grow some plants.
But we'll talk about that more in a minute.
We will. I'm sure we will. But this is also why frozen food is actually pretty decent sometimes. Or frozen vegetables, I should say. This is because often vegetables are flash frozen as soon as they're harvested or shortly thereafter. So the nutrients are actually contained in those vegetables versus something that's harvested and put on a boat or plane or train, sent to you, you know, and it reaches you 3 weeks later.
That's interesting because I think that there's this idea that frozen vegetables are not as good quality as fresh ones.
Yeah, sometimes it depends. Like, again, super fresh is better, but fresh that comes from far away might not be as good as frozen, depending. So there's all these little nuances here that are kind of interesting. But in general, lower amount of food miles, the food travels, less environmental impact for that food to come to you. You're supporting nutrient density because you're looking for healthy and flavorful food. And also when you're shopping, look for pigmentation. That's one of my favorite things to think about and simple tricks. The deeper, the darker the color of the fruit or vegetable, the more nutrient density it has. And it usually means it came from better farms.
How do you recommend, though, that people get their variety if they're living alone, for example? Because so often you have to buy in bulk, and I don't need 20 carrots if it's just me, you know, making food for 1 week. It means I've got to have carrots every single day, like you were saying about broccoli.
For sure. And I actually have a bunch of carrots in my house now that you're telling me that.
These carrots last a little longer, but
I was gonna bring
maybe
you,
not
I was,
with the
I was,
nutrients.
I was going to bring you some today, but I'm glad I didn't because you have... I can drop
some
off for you.
Oh, actually, I don't. I was just using it as an example.
Cheeky. I've been trying to get into the habit of a little more of like a European style where I keep basic stuff at my house, but I'll just go to the market more frequently and I'll buy less.
And a farmer's market, I think you're able to buy, you know, 5 carrots and 3 apples or something like that, a
exactly.
little bit more. But if you're going to a store and you have to buy them in bags and packets and things like that, would you say cooking it up and then freezing it would be a good tip to people? So still buying, you know, a variety like that? How do you recommend that people can still get that variety if they don't have farmer's markets available to them?
It's a good question. I think meal prep is always great. I think that's always a good way to do it. Freezing is also very good. My grandmother would be very happy with that. Depending on what it is, you could pickle it, you could jar it, but I would just try to buy less. And also, like, just from a food waste perspective, I've been trying to be way more conscientious of that as well. Like, we waste so much food. In the U.S., 40 to 50% of the food that is grown is wasted.
That much?
40 to 50%. So that's if emissions from food waste were a country, they would be the third largest emitter in the world behind the United States and China.
That's
so
crazy.
So, and also it's $320 billion a year in food waste.
Well, what can we do to address that kind of issue then? Because obviously, you might say it's the stores buying in too much, so it's not being eaten, but then maybe the problem is further back than that. You know, we're actually growing too much. So where do you think that the problem lies and where could we actually tackle it if we had any options in the world to do so?
Sure. I mean, I think first it's we're growing too much of the wrong kind of food. Mm-hmm. You know, we could grow 90% less corn and soy if we weren't feeding it to cattle. So that would free up a lot of space. One, I think two, we've grown up in a culture and in a time when they're just, we've been so used to this idea of abundance. We've been so used to this idea of you go to the store and it's always full of everything from everywhere and you don't really think about it. And when there's 10,000 apples in the store, you know, when one gets moldy, you're going to throw it away. And there's very little impact for any of us. And I think we need to change the paradigm. We need to change the lens through which we see our impact on the planet. And I'm not saying that I've never wasted food, but being more conscientious of the food that's coming into your house. And then composting, you know, anything that doesn't get made into something or food scrap, or even if you make food and it's leftovers, or even if you order takeout and there's leftovers, composting is a huge component. And that means that all those nutrients are being collected and can be revitalized and turned into something more productive.
I don't think enough people know about composting. As far as I know, amongst my friends and my community, I'm like one of the few people that actually does it. And I think there's many reasons behind that, but let me let you talk on it.
What's your composting situation, Louise?
We have green bins in the street.
Yeah, totally.
And so my top tip for composting is to have a bag in the freezer. People don't like to have them on the countertop because flies come in, it smells. So just pop it straight in the freezer, keep it in a bag, and then I take it out to the green bins every week. But what I realize now is that those green bins go all the way to Bakersfield, which is, for people listening who don't know, hundreds of miles away in order to go to the compost site. Whereas if you can do it locally, like within your own backyard is what you're talking about, you know, you're actually not using all those emissions to get your compost to somewhere to actually be composted, which is kind of crazy in another way.
Totally. And even the green bin thing is great. It's better than the alternative. Like it's, I think in this transition, composting is often one of the first acts of regeneration that many of us do and take part in. And one of the things that we can do on a daily basis to have a regenerative impact.
It's amazing how much it accumulates. I have to say, you know, my bag in the freezer, little bag, like fills up pretty quick.
Totally. And all of that, instead of all of those food scraps going into garbage and just contributing methane in some hole somewhere or on some pile somewhere, you're having a net negative impact. Right there, your consumption is contributing to climate change. You probably don't realize it. We have been conditioned to it, but it is. By contrast, if you remove just the food scraps and you're no longer contributing to that methane. And then those food scraps combined with leaves and other organic matter in a pile can turn into eventually this like chocolate cake compost that is rocket fuel for plants in the garden, you know, indoor plants, this little cactus, whatever you want to grow. And it's really incredible. It really is. And so that little switch means that your consumption was having a net negative impact, and now your consumption is having a net positive impact. Throughout the process of making the film, we were super inspired by all of these experts we were meeting with, and we were asking them about the different impact that we can have, etc. And one of the things they kept saying to us was, you know, growing food in your front yard or growing food in your backyard, growing something can have a really big impact. So we were like, all right, we can do that. And we got little tips here and there, bury your food waste, et cetera, et cetera. And so we just started basically ripping up our lawn. Lawns are the most irrigated crop in the United States. The most amount of water that we use is for lawns, and it produces no food. And we started to transition our lawn from just a regular lawn into a garden. And now it's kind of a permaculture experiment. Actually, you've got to come see it, see how it's evolved. It is quite wonderful. Honestly, there's multiple different types of trees and plants. Right now we have kale and tomatoes and a bunch of different types of herbs. There's a bunch of different pollinator flowers. There were zero pollinators, and now there are hummingbirds, butterflies, bees, all different types of insects, spiders, ladybugs. It is a whole ecosystem.
Wow.
That is really special, and it's totally transformed my relationship with plants and food. And I used to think that I didn't have a green thumb or I couldn't plant stuff. And over time and with some trial and error, I planted a lot of things. And the best part is that it has totally transformed our relationship with our community. I think the goal and the vision should be, how can we work with the environment at every part of the process to enhance it? And how can we sequester carbon? How can we build pollinator habitats? And the water issue is interesting because yes, it uses a little bit of water, but the amount of water that's actually used is not that significant. And if you're using turf, you are not capturing any of the water when it does rain, versus if you have a, you know, not a lawn, but some kind of a garden or some kind of system, even just where the soil is covered. Every time it rains, you are drawing down that rain and you're storing it down below, which is going to make the whole system more resilient to climate change. And you're not putting plastic in your front yard, which is made with petrochemicals that, again, come from somewhere far away.
Which are harming us in some way, shape, or form anyway.
And there's no, and there will be no insects because there's no native plants.
Yeah.
So it just...
The whole ecosystem in your garden sounds amazing. And I love that it brings all of the community together. And I know that that is something that you actually aim to do with Common Table Creative as well. Alongside making your documentary, you were always doing these dinner parties that you focused on. Are you still doing those?
Absolutely. So, when we first started, we realized that, you know, as a production company, our mission is to educate and inspire people to think differently about food and our broader consumption, and to help transition us from having a negative impact on the world to having a positive impact. And we do that through films, documentaries, and short form content, and also dinners. We feel like hospitality and films and storytelling are two of the most powerful vehicles of change.
And you still want to get your chefing in.
And I still like to get my chefing in. That's correct. I left the restaurant business, but I still love hospitality. I don't need to open restaurants anymore, but we still love to bring people together. And in addition to just making films, we wanted to be part of the community, and we wanted to be a leading voice in the community and to help bring together all of these different people we've met along the way who are doing great things in the world of food. And if we can bring people together around the table and include amazing farmers, that's what we want to do.
I love that you're involved from every little section, from seed right through to serving it on the table. So where can people kind of find out about these dinners?
They can find out on our website. There's a place to sign up for our dinners on our website, commontablecreative.com. Follow us on Instagram as well, commontablecreative. You can send us a DM if you want to be added. We have a dinner list as well. We kind of send out invitations, but we'll start doing some stuff again this summer.
Put my name down on that list, please.
Can I, Louise? I think I will.
Thank you very much. And Feeding Tomorrow, just to reiterate again, is available to watch on Apple TV, on Google Play, and also
Amazon Prime.
Plus,
and we're in the skies.
And we're in the skies. Well, thank you so much, Oliver. This has been a really insightful conversation, and one that's been really important, and one that I know many of our listeners have been very curious to hear about. So thanks for your time today. We'll be posting more about Oliver English and everything that he's doing on our Instagram page, and you can keep up to date with what we're doing on the Be Curious podcast there too. So head over to @BeCurious_podcast for more information. My name is Louise Houghton, and if you liked what you heard today, please like, follow, share, and subscribe. And we will see you next time on the Be Curious podcast. Stay curious.